This is an ABC podcast.
This is Stories from the Pacific with Bobby McCumber on ABC Radio Australia.
Hi, I'm Bobby McCumber. Thanks for joining me today on Stories from the Pacific on ABC Radio Australia. Today you'll meet a young Papua New Guinean man, Jordan Morris. Jordan's been drawing since as long as he can remember. He started by holding children's books up to the window and tracing around the images. While he might describe these drawings as just doodles, they were much more than that. As a child, he discovered that drawing offered an alternate universe, especially during times of upheaval, like when his parents were going through a messy divorce. Now, recognised as one of the country's leading visual artists, Jordan uses art to tell stories from his homeland. And just as when he was a child, drawing is a place of solace. Welcome, Jordan.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
Now, Jordan, can you describe the village that you grew up in Papua New Guinea?
I grew up in Mount Hagen, so which is regarded as the third largest city, and that's in quotations, in PNG. It's up in the mountains, and it's very, very cold. And I grew up most of my, even when I learned how to draw, like everything started in Hagen, or Mount Hagen, as a lot of people call it.
Now, like a lot of Pacific Islanders, you come from a big family.
Yes, I come from a very, very big family. So we know that, you know, I am the first son of the third wife. So it's a lot of Papua New Guineans understand that family dynamic and structure, I guess. Yes, and I have a lot of siblings, but from my mum in particular, there's seven of us, and I'm the first of the seven.
How did your parents meet?
My mom married my father during a time when she was studying. She was doing her first year in law, a bachelor's in law, and she was freshman into university, and then met my father. So I think around that time, like it was, she was very young when she met my father. My father had already been married with kids and two wives prior, so it's sort of like a controversial thing at that time within our little community in Hagen. But yeah, but with men in particular, like a lot of our fathers, and even I have uncles, brothers, and even friends, you know, who have multiple women as wives, and that is commonly accepted in PNG, but it's frowned upon, but it still is a common practice. So, and obviously I come from a family like that as well, so it's like, with marriages like that, it often falls apart in the sense that it's a repetitive pattern of a man marrying and divorcing and then marrying again, divorcing. But in contrast to like the West, or let's say like Australia, we don't have proper like divorce or settlement or court like that. We do, but it's not very common. It's just that the wife just accept that there is another woman, because there were women prior to, like in the case of my mom. So, yeah, and then you just get like pushed to the side with your kids and the man just go marry someone else. It's, I don't know a better way of describing this or the best way, but the only way I know is that it's an accepted reality. My parents ended their marriage because my father obviously wanted a new wife.
What did drawing offer you when you're going through such a tumultuous time at home?
Trying to understand what was happening around me at that time, you know, seeing my sisters and because we were separated from our mother, our dad took custody of us. We were the only kids that he took custody of. So around that time, like drawing provided a space where I had to be distracted from my reality. I started sketching and going back to it and creating these things, because when I saw what I could create, it's a conscious sort of shift, but also creating something beautiful out of it. I understand that now. At that time, I never understood why I was doing it.
You said that your dad took care of you after the separation. What did this mean for your relationship with your mum?
Like what I remember from it, it's the relationship with my mother was very distant. And at that time, the separation happened when we didn't have phones and we didn't have, social media, nothing. There was no connection. When we moved to Goroka from Mount Hagen, the school that I went to, my mom found out that I went to that school, and the separation wasn't a good one as well. So our father completely cut off communication with her. So we had no way of communicating with her. So when she found out from a teacher who taught at that school, who went to high school with her, So what she did was she got the address for the school and she started writing letters to school every week. Every week she would write letters to the school and she would address it to me. And every time you have the principal's boy, I think the assistant, it's just like, you know, someone that's the caretaker of the school, just runs around with a yellow envelope. I always remember that. And this was like early 2000s. And just to look for me, to give me, you know, the letter from mum. So that's how I kept communication with her.
How was that feeling when you received those letters from your mum?
It felt great. It felt great because it was just, you know, as a kid growing up, if your father says no, it's no. You don't argue, like in the PNG, you know, like you don't argue back because, you know, there's repercussions for it. You know, you get punished for it. You just accept that. And it's sort of like, it sort of creates a suppression that, like I said, now I understand what was happening. Back then, I accepted it because I thought that was normal. That was okay. And like thinking about this is like, it's at that time, it was just very, very tricky. I thought this was okay. And this was like, this is my life. And that's what everyone was going through. And I didn't realize that I am probably like one of the few people going through it at that time as well.
It's a lot to get your head around as a young kid as well. Mm. Did you have to keep that communication secret from the rest of your family?
Yes, very much so. Because like I said, you know, the separation was not, it was a nasty separation, I'd say. You know, you have your father's side of the family, and this is where it goes back to being a tribal thing as well, because now the whole tribe is involved and they say things like, oh, you know, your mother left you. And as a kid, you don't know what happened during the marriage, but you just take that as a fact. Oh, your mother left you. You know, your mother didn't want to take care of you. Or your mother abandoned you. So you believe that. So that's what we were, you know, hearing in the house and stuff like that. But when I started to get letters from mom, she would explain every situation because she knew I was young. So she would explain certain things about the marriage. So I started to have an understanding of what actually happened. So I had to keep, and she told me every time to keep it a secret. So, and I always put those letters, unfortunately, I don't have those letters because it was a very long time ago. Mm. But I always hid those letters. I would pretend like nothing happened and just, you know, I kept them to myself.
Did you ever have the opportunity to respond?
Yes. And I couldn't write back to her. So what I would do is she would put her phone number or she would tell me a certain time to call a certain number. So because she wasn't working at that time. So what I would do is I'd go to the payphone and there used to be a long line after school. So I'd go to the payphone. She'll write a number down on the letter. And she would like call me at this time. So I would make sure I'm at the payphone and I'd call her with the spare change I had from lunch. I'd call her to speak to her. I was like, I got your letter. Thank you. And sometimes in those letters, she would put money in it as well. Like she put like notes of 5 kina, 10 kina in PNG. And sometimes if she puts 20 kina in, I buy lunch for all my classmates.
This is such a huge secret to keep as a child.
My father probably, if he listens to this, he will probably find that out now. Yeah.
What was life like at home for you and your siblings?
Very, very tough. Because now that I think back to it, at that time, like I said, it was a norm thing. It's normal. And I accepted it. But now looking back, it was very tough. And I don't know how I, you know, handled, you know, at that couple of years after that, my fourth sister was born. And it's like all these little kids and, you know, growing up. And then dad's remarried again. So we're growing up with different women coming into his life. So we're experiencing them as they transition through and, you know, like, you know, come into our family, share, you know, 1-2 years, they go off, another woman comes in. It's been like that. So we had different women coming into his life, you know. And like I said, it's a normal thing. We accepted it. We never called them by their names because it's disrespectful because, you know, cultural. And, you know, if that's your father's wife, that's your mother, regardless of what it is. So we call them mom, you know. So, and that leads me to say that the word mom in our house, between me and my sisters, has lost its meaning over the years because we called every woman that our father married mom.
What was your relationship like with your dad throughout all of this?
Very distant, but he provided. He made sure my school fees, you know, my fees were paid. He made sure I had money to go to school. But what I was going through emotionally as a child, I wasn't able to tell him that, hey, dad, I miss mom. We couldn't say that because we were told that mom abandoned us. So when I started to find out the truth about the situation, you know, at that time, mom wasn't telling me the whole entire truth, but just bits of why she's not here. So I would try to communicate that with the girls, my sisters at the time, and I tell them, hey, do not tell dad about this and that we know about this and stuff like that, because dad was, at that point, he was at the peak of his life. Like he had so much money. He had all of these things, and he was a very important public figure in the rugby league arena. So we barely see him, but he made sure that we were okay, that we had, food in the house. We had everything that we needed. And he made sure that there was someone taking care of us.
Was your father and the rest of your family supportive of your art practice?
Well, that's the thing. Art in PNG, they weren't very supportive. The reason being that art was seen as a struggle component of people in the lower class. And coming from the family that I came from, when I did art, they told me that I needed to focus on my studies and just get rid of that and stop wasting my time. That's the kind of conversations they were having at the house. Like, this is like my uncles, my stepmothers would tell me this. My half-brothers would tell me things like that. And not from my sisters, because they love what I do and everything that I do. They idolize me from that age. That's why the judgment came from people who saw a potential. They were like, we're paying for your fees and doing all of this for you, but why are you doing art? Like, you need to go and do something else. Because art was associated with struggles of people living below the poverty line, because people would sell art on the streets in PNG everywhere. And you could see that, they're trying to make a living by using this skill. So when I did that, they thought that I was emulating that. And that's why they talked down on it. This is a conversation that a lot of people, they don't understand. And coming from, a family like mine, who was compared to, at that time was very, very well off. They saw it as an insult or something like that to the family, but they never understood the reason why I kept doing it. And it got to the point where I, in my own house, I would hide in the middle of the night and I would draw.
Did you tell your mum about your passion for drawing?
Oh, yes. I think when she first saw my artwork in 2008, that's when camera phones dropped in PNG at the time. And I took a photo and I sent it to her via email at that time. And the first photo of my artwork was of a tribal painting that I did. And I sent it to her and she was just speechless. She had to call me. She had to call me and said, that was amazing. So I think I was doing art also because one person that I wanted approval from and I wanted something from was her. So when she gave me that, that mattered more than my family, the rest of my family trying to tell me that art isn't a real thing and I should focus on my study. So I got the approval from mum at that time. So I knew that I knew that someone that I adore and love actually appreciates what I do. So that it didn't stop me. So that's sort of fuel to the fire, I'd say.
You're listening to Stories from the Pacific on ABC Radio Australia. I'm Bobby McCumber and I'm talking with PNG artist Jordan Morris. Now, Jordan, you've pursued art as a young adult. Tell me where your ideas begin when you create artwork.
They begin at a place where I like to celebrate. I like to celebrate things, regardless of what it is. I like to give meaning to simple, mundane things. If I draw a kundu drum, for example, I don't just draw it. I like to celebrate the drum and what it means and where it comes from. And I think about the kundu drum was a communication medium back in the past. You go by the count of the beats, or you go by the sound of it, or you go by, the rhythm. There's stories be like, at the sound of the third, beating, this means that something is happening, or this is, it's a communication medium. So I try to celebrate that at a time. Like, we look back now, we have all this tech and all these things going on. And at that time, this wasn't an important piece of communication, communicating instrument. So I tried to celebrate that by drawing them in sort of a grand, large scale to give it when you look at them, it's almost like it's standing over you. But I tried to use and give meaning to things that we take for granted, like modern PNG takes for granted. They see it as a drum. And I was like, no, this was your great-grandfather's telephone, if anything. Like, this was saving lives. This was telling people that the enemies were coming, this piece of instrument. That's why I tie it. When I draw something from a specific area, I use the designs from that area. I tie it in with the object. It's more like symbolic. So that's where little things I'll find, you know, interesting, and I'll give meaning to it. But then also when I do these things, people come back to me and say, oh, I have a story from my area about this one. And I love that you brought this here because I can see some of it from here. That's that part that, you know, allowing the viewer of what I create to make up their own stories, but also to associate and derive meaning from it. And that's why I never stop. That's where the ideas, they come from. It's just a celebration of the simple things.
Getting back to your mum, you Yes. recently reconnected with her. How did that come about?
So as we grew older, the parents' restrictions of our father became a little bit more, not a secret anymore. So we openly talked to her because we're grown adults, and, you know, we communicate with her, but we still weren't allowed to see her. So we just, you know, we did our own thing, and for our own safety and for our own, you know, benefit, we stayed away from her. I applied to a couple of unis here and to come down here to study. And I was going through some problems at the house with my half siblings. And I was like, okay, I can't live here. And I need to just go out and, you know, like find, you know, PNG isn't the world for me. I mean, it is home for me, but I can venture out. And, you know, I had friends at that point who were living here and studying here. So I spoke to my mom briefly, and I said, hey, I'm going to go down to Australia, and I'm going to go do this and do this and do that. And from that moment on, when she saw that drive in me, she made time for me as much as she could, and she pushed me. So that's how we rekindled our relationship, because, you know, growing up and believing one side of the story and all of this, like at a grown age, she pushed me. She pushed me, and I saw that she, you know, what people were saying was not true, because I can see her heart and where it was and where it is. And, you know, and then she always tells me things like, you know, she never, she regrets a lot of things in her life and stuff like that, but never her kids. And she was so proud of what I was doing. So I saw that. I saw her playing that motherly role at a very late stage of my life. Like, I mean, not very late, sorry. At a, you know, later stage of my life. And that sort of provided me with, be like, okay, I know what I went through with our family and, you know, the separation and all of that, but there is still some chance and opportunities here for her to contribute into my life. So I allowed her to, and that's how relationship became. We rekindled that, and we were close. We became very close. Even distant, we were still close. We were always a phone call away.
So at this point, her health wasn't great.
Yes. Last year, I was just at home. I got a text from a family friend of ours, and said, oh, hey, I'm just reaching out to you and just letting you know that your mom is at the hospital, and she's diagnosed with stage 3 cervical cancer. And this was out of the blue, because all I knew that she was okay because she told me she was. And I thought, I had to look at the calendar. It was like, is this April 1st? Like, is it like Fool's Day? Like, what's going on? Like, I had to quickly, because it just took me by surprise. I called the person back on Messenger, and I said, hey, so your message, like, can you explain what that means? And she goes, oh, yeah, she's being diagnosed with stage 3 cervical cancer. And I was like, oh, well, wow. Like, I was speechless. And I said, well, how long had this? Because at that time, mom had already remarried as well. So, you know, she was with someone else, and we just had a very, you know, strange relationship, even with my stepdad. So we don't speak that much. But at that time, I was like, okay, so when was this? When did you guys find out? Like, she hasn't said anything to me or anything like that. And my sisters as well, like, we don't know what's going on. And she just said, well, we found out about 2 months prior. So this 2 months when she had a diagnosis, and on top of that, she had a stroke when she found out that she had cancer. So it paralyzed half of her body. And that's why she hasn't reached out to us, because it paralyzed half of her body and she went completely mute. And we didn't know for 2 months they were keeping this a secret. So my sisters were in Fiji that time studying, and I was here as well. And I was completely taken by surprise, because I was meant to graduate from UQ in December last year. And she, when I spoke to her about coming back here and finishing off my master's degree, she's like, okay, I'll come down and finally, you know, like, we'll just, you know, be a family. If we can, we can try. You know, your kids are grown now, so you guys can make your own decisions, and you guys can come and see me. I'll be in Australia, you know, and we can all be together to celebrate your achievement. So that was the conversation where we left off. So that took me by surprise with the news of her diagnosis. So that at that point in time, like it was just like my whole world just came crashing down because I was like, oh my goodness, like it was a nightmare. It was a nightmare just to hear that. And yeah.
What did you do when you got this news?
The first thing I did was I went and I bought a canvas because I did not know what to do. And I started drawing. So I started to channel all my anxiety and my fear of what could happen and, you know, what will happen and this news that I heard. And I spent 3 weeks inside the house with three canvases. And I had to tell myself that everything is going to be fine. I did two artworks and then I flew up to PNG to go and see her. And she finally got to see an artwork that I did of myself and her when I was a little boy. This was after not seeing her for this long, the first time I saw her, and she couldn't say anything back to me in person. So I just stood there and I was like, hey, mom, look at this. And she saw it and, you know, a tear came down her eyes. And I was like, this is a sketch for what I'm going to do next. You know, remember the story you told me about the black woman? The sketch is here and I'm going to do it and you're going to see it. You just need to help me by getting better, you know. That's a conversation I had with her last.
It must have been very emotional for you.
Very much,
and then,
yes.
In August last year, the illness took hold?
Yes. We tried getting her the help she needed in PNG, and they told us that she needs to be medevaced to either Australia or to another, like Singapore or Philippines. So we had those three options, and we finally got the help that she needed. I put up all my artworks. Like when I found out that, you know, we had a chance of beating this and, you know, just giving her a chance at survival at least. I put up all my artworks up for auction for discount. I reached out to people. I was like, hey, you know, we're medevacing someone is not cheap. And I use every asset, every creation I've done, everything to put them up to raise money and to get her the help that she needs. And we finally got the help around like August, in mid-August. We got the help we needed and we had a lot of generous people showing love and support and prayers and bringing food. Like I've seen the heart of ordinary Papua New Guineans like showing up because my mother's illness was, my stepdad, you know, reached out to the public as well and went on to the media. So the story was plastered all over the media in PNG. And we had people, business houses coming in numbers and showing support. We got the help she needed. We flew her to Philippines. And within 24 hours of our arrival, she succumbed to a second stroke. And that took over 90% of her body and she passed away.
How has your mum's death impacted you?
I'd say it's like June, I found out the news. July, I flew up. And then August, like within the 3 months of that. So I'm learning how to cope. I'm learning how to cope with it without it taking over me with the years of, with the years of not being able to see her. Like, it's like I'm doing the best I can to cope, but I don't allow myself to get to a point where I let it take control over me because I know that I've got so much to lose in the process because I've got my siblings, you know, my younger brothers and sisters, they're dependent on me for emotional support and they always see me, again, you know, as a role model for them. So being, you know, the tribal part of things as well, you know, going back to the village and doing the old customary, you know, funeral services. And I was so busy, I never had time to grieve and everything, but I'm more at peace because during her struggle as well, like it's not a good thing to see your parent or, you know, anyone that you love struggle. Like, and she wasn't doing well. And we wanted to know that we did everything that we could and we did everything that, you know, I did everything a son could. My sisters did everything that, you know, daughters could and would have. And they'd done everything, you know. They took care of her at the hospital. They left the school in Fiji. They flew into PNG and they withdrew from university there and they were taking care of her. You know, they were on shifts, you know, on routine. And we told the younger kids, it's okay. We got it. You know, the four of us, we stepped up and we did everything we could. So I think my piece is that she doesn't have to be in pain anymore because it was just not something that, it's bittersweet. She's not in pain anymore, but everything that could have been, I can either sit here and think about reuniting and looking forward to the day that we would reunite after over 21 years of not seeing each other. But that is like, that's the worst thing that could happen to me, I think. And it has happened, but I've dealt with it the best way I can. And I can tell you confidently that I owe it to my art and my little escapism. You know, every time I feel a negative thought coming in, I run to the canvas. So yeah, that's been good. Like, that's been my support.
So drawing has helped.
100%. 100%. And it's like every time I do something, I do it with her in mind. I think my work since she passed, it's all been about her and the things that she's been telling me and the stories that she told me, you know, when we were kids growing up, you know. She'd tell me stories about the land, you know, about religion before missionaries came to PNG. She'd tell me all of this. So now I'm channeling that in onto the canvas and to create these pieces that that tells the story. And that's the thing I love about my mother, because she was so into the culture, and people were moving out of it, but she was living in it. She was living in it, and she embraced it, and that sort of rubbed off to me as well. So, and even to my siblings as well, you know, they love stories, and we call them Tumbuna stories in PNG. And these stories, you know, they shaped the society before us, you know, like you know, the previous, and they held on to those and the meanings and the parables and the tales. Like, she left me, at least, you know, with this gift of wanting to be the storyteller, you know. And that's the thing, you know. She read books to me, and then I was like, no, I don't want to hear stories about from the books. I want to hear stories about this mountain, you know. What happened, you know, people say it's a sister facing that way, and that's another sister facing this way, and the stone is, you know, where the chiefs they met, and what about that? Tell me that. And she was so educated about all of this that she would tell me. And I'd go back to the village, sit with the elders, and I'll extract the stories from them. And there's so much to put onto the canvas. And now, like, even after her passing, like, that's my saving grace, is wanting to be able to tell the stories that she told me.
You started drawing as a kid. Now at 28, you're quickly becoming one of PNG's most notable up-and-coming artists. Did you ever imagine it, the doodling would lead to this?
I bet my life on it, no. And right now, I am very, very grateful for, like, this. I would say the modern term, or the more appropriate term, was the viral moment, I think. I got with social media, especially TikTok, with over 2 million views of, like, a single piece. It's gone to the point where it's gone right across the world. It's insane.
Your mum has been encouraging you to pursue art since you were a little boy. Do you think she'll be proud of your success?
Just even with this, like, I would have called her up, like, hey, mom, I got an interview with ABC. Like, this is the things that, you know, it's like I said, it's bittersweet. Even it's, you know, I can't tell her about, you know, the exhibition that, you know, in Sydney, or the one that's coming up. You can't tell her that, but I know that wherever she is from the outside looking in, like, I know that she's seeing it. Like, you know, I think that's something that, you know, makes me, like, gives me peace. So I don't have to tell her now, that because now she's here, you know, wherever she is, and she's watching me doing this thing. So I don't have to tell her anything anymore, because now she's seeing it firsthand, wherever she may be.
Ah, Jordan, thank you so much for joining me here today.
Thank you so much for having me.
That was Papua New Guinean artist Jordan Morris. If you'd like to see Jordan's work, just look for @GrimJordan on Instagram. You've been listening to Stories from the Pacific on ABC Radio Australia with me, Bobby McCumba. You can listen to more great stories about incredible people from the Pacific. Just head to the website and search ABC Pacific.